I wanted to ask each of you before we take questions, and we want to leave plenty of time for your questions and have a conversation with you. But each of you, starting with you, David, how has Katrina changed you as a journalist?
You know, I've been asked that question so many times because in our business, you're just taught to be dispassionate. You're taught to be arm's length. And all that teaching doesn't calculate the worst natural disaster in the history of the country hitting your house. I mean, your exact house, your friends' homes, your colleagues' homes, the place where you live, and you're not. It's not the same. You cannot resist getting involved in the story. You can't resist becoming part of it and really wanting to do what you can to help. And, you know, you couldn't ride through town in that newspaper truck if you were me and see kids who didn't have water or anything, and we would hand them our fruit cups, our water, anything we had, because we knew we had the ability to get more, and they didn't. And I think it definitely changes you in that way, and it gives you a different perspective on what it's like to be on the other side of this, to cover something and to be covered. And by that I mean all of the misconceptions about what happened in New Orleans, all of the incorrect reporting about what the challenges are in our levee system, and is it the city's dead and all that. You get defensive about it. And I think that's been the range of emotions I've had in the past year.
Manuel?
I think, David, it's pointing out the main difference. And it leads you to really, like he say, just, you know, when you go and write about people whom you do not personally know, no matter what the circumstances they are, you can keep sort of a cool about it. You may feel angry about what they're going through, but it's not what you are going through. You know, you get to the disaster, and you know that when you're done with your day and you file your story, there's a hot shower and a warm bed waiting for you. Well, not this time. I think it really made us I think the reason you have seen some very good work from everybody at the paper is because, you know, this is not someone else's story we're covering. It's ours. And we're trying, I think a lot of us feel a sense of, because of what David was saying, you know, the way the national media is portraying this in many ways is not accurate. So we have to set the record straight and speak for those who can't. I mean, we share the anger that many of you have had this year, because we felt it through. We're also calling our insurance companies. It's a common joke within the paper that a phone call from your contractor or your insurance agent will get you out of any meeting with the publisher, with anything. It doesn't matter. Your phone ring and it's your contractor. You're out of there. And it's really not a joke. It's the way things have been. And so, I don't know if I will have it any other way, though. You know, if this city had gone through what this city went through and we hadn't gone through it, I don't think we would have been prepared to cover it the way we have. So, in a sense, I'm not glad we went through it, but I'm sure it was fortunate that we lived it through also, so we can tell the story the way it really is.
Doug?
After the Katrina experience, I'm a much tougher art critic. I think what I learned most was deadline writing. I usually have 2 or 3 days to think about. It's remarkable that I make mistakes, but I have 3 or 4 days to ponder them before they become print. And in Katrina, it was like, you know, I would go and report on something, and somebody wanted that in an hour and a half, and it was terrifying. But
for me, I would say that I learned about journalists that were wired up a little differently than other people, and that when there's danger and disaster and risk, we run towards it instead of running away from it. And the reactions that we received from the people that we saw and talked to on our reporting journeys that day told us that how important it was for us to be there. I mean, when Doug and I arrived on the Fillmore Avenue Bridge over the only canal in Lakeview that didn't collapse, the Orleans Avenue Canal, there were about 35 people who had been evacuated from their second stories or their rooftops on that bridge, surrounded by water. They were literally an island. And they were overjoyed to see us, and it was a defining moment for me as a journalist to realize that even though we had nothing for them, we were going to tell their story, and that was the most important thing to them. So I now understand our job as first responders in times of crisis, not exactly in the way that fire and police and emergency responders are, but in a similar vein, that we need to be here when things happen to tell people stories and to catalog what happened. We would like to take many of your questions. I'm sure you have questions, and talk about the coverage. One of the most pressing issues of evacuating was that of evacuating the newspaper was that we had about 150 people at the newspaper who were family members of employees. So in some sense, civilians, if you will, who hadn't really bought into, let's spend a week in the city covering the storm. And we had elderly people, we had people in wheelchairs, we had infants at the paper when the water came in. So it was very, very important for us to get out and get our employees' family members out of the city. And ended up, most of us, in Baton Rouge with not a lot of places to sleep. It was a bit of a mad scramble.
You want to know where we slept? Does that answer your question? Yeah. We slept everywhere, just anywhere you could find a spot, floors.
Inside of a car.
I guess you all remember it was deathly hot during those days. I tried sleeping outside at one point. That is great for mosquitoes, but not for me. It was tough conditions.
I just have one comment. I was at the prayer breakfast this morning at the Marriott for first responders, for police, fire, and EMS. And there were hundreds of people in the room.
And I was surprised by one event. Many people were recognized. The chair recognized two executives from Walmart and recognized their help in provisioning police, fire, first responders. And that group, or those two people from Walmart, got the longest standing ovation of the morning. And I just thought people ought to know that.
Well, you know, I saw those trucks. Walmart got sacked, obviously, and people wondered what they would do. But at one point, we were on the West Bank, I think, going down to Houma to get more supplies. And there had to be 40 Walmart trucks come by, headed into town, way before the soldiers got here.
Days.
Way before the federal government got here, Walmart was here.
But it wasn't just New Orleans as well. It's striking to me, Tuesday night, the night after the storm, we were in Baton Rouge. I went into Walmart at about 2 o'clock in the morning after working, you know, your typical 18-hour day in those days to buy some clothing because I really didn't have much. I had literally the clothes on my back. And the Walmart looked, in Baton Rouge, was looted in a polite way, but it was basically stripped bare. The grocery side of the store was absolutely stripped bare. And I went into Walmart on Wednesday morning, and this is only 2 days after the storm in Baton Rouge, and it was fully restocked. So the logistical firepower that a company has to bring to do that, and it was essential to do that because, as you all know, 100,000 people arrived in Baton Rouge Monday and Tuesday, was extraordinary to see and absolutely essential.
All we need now is for, you know, Walmart to take over FEMA.
And a question for Mr. Meeks with dealing with the Walmart and any other looting that you saw. Did you see, when you came on the scene, did anyone show remorse and say, my God, what am I doing, and move away from it, or were they too caught up in the moment to do that?
It was more like a scene from Mad Max or The Road Warrior. I mean, there were two kinds of looters, to be sure. There were people in pretty desperate straits taking food and water, and you could understand that. And there were people taking electronics, which you couldn't understand that. And there were law enforcement people who were not participating in the looting but did feel pretty helpless to stop it. I mean, this had reached a point where the number of people going in was just so high. In fact, I remember seeing a sort of a looter traffic jam where there were so many looters trying to carry stuff out that the new looters couldn't get in. And this one officer began directing the looters to, like, you know, get things more organized. And I guess that was just how you had to handle it.
Yeah, there was a great sense of ambivalence. I mean, I had a great sense of ambivalence because, there, you know, I don't know what the police could have done to turn back the tide.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I saw there was a big glass case that had all electronic games, you know, television games in them, and kids were reaching into the glass case through, you know, the broken glass to get the games out. And I saw a policeman come up and take his metal baton and bust out the rest of the glass so that the kids wouldn't, you know, cut themselves. So there was always this sense of it, you know.
I've spoken to some Our guys who cover crime, and I myself have had the chance to talk to a few officers and some officers in the NOPD, and their explanation sometimes for they were the first to admit that there were rotten apples, and you know, they're taking care of a lot of those. But they also say that a lot of what they did was similar. They compare it to what they often do in Mardi Gras. You know, they don't arrest every person who gets in a street brawl in Mardi Gras, because otherwise they will arrest half of the city. Their words was, you need escape valve. And, you know, we were losing control. There was really no control, and we just didn't have enough manpower to keep a control in the city, so we had to just kind of, you know, regulate avenues. If someone pulled a gun, then we would intervene, but, you know, if it was, I think his words were, peaceful looting, they kind of let it ride a little bit.
I will say the one section of the Walmart that just remained untouched was the book section. Which struck me as strange, because it was kind of the one thing you could use.
The one thing you could use, indeed.
In the weeks after the storm.
I have a two-part question. A few of you have mentioned that you feel the national press misreported or misrepresented the situation, and I was wondering if you would identify two or three things, important ways in which that is so. And the second part is, I'm wondering if you have a sense of how the Baton Rouge Advocate did in its reporting job, and if you could characterize their perspective on the situation from it being outsiders, but also experiencing the influx.
I'm the one guy who can't comment on the other media during the crisis, because I never saw any of it. I was here. But I will say that the one thing that bothers me about the national reporting is this sense that we are an unprotectable city, and that this storm overwhelmed our levee system, and there was nothing that could have been done to prevent it, and that is simply not true. And secondly, that they don't report that we have three distinct levee systems that have a different level of protectability depending on which part of the city you live in. So I wish they would get it right on those two issues. Protecting New Orleans from flooding and surge is not impossible. It's not even that complicated. It just wasn't done.
I think there's also an unwillingness on the part of the national media to really hold the government accountable for what happened here. And we all know that all we really asked of the Corps is that they build a wall that not fall down. And a great deal of our woe and misery would not be what it is today if they could build a wall that did not fall down. So in some measure, when I talk around the country on this, I compare it to if NASA launched a rocket and it fell on your house, no one would question the government's responsibility to make you whole. But because a rocket fell on 200,000 houses, the government wants to sort of hem and haw and say, well, you know, we can only give this much money and we can't really fix all of it. And so there's sort of a failure to really, I think, on the part of the national media, hold the government accountable to the degree that they should be held accountable.
A number of years ago, I remember reading in the paper that the canal that they built despite the guys who brought the ships in had leaked. And some of the houses were flooded in a minor way. And it was suggested that perhaps they should reinforce that canal. And the answer that was given, and it's written somewhere, because I read it, it's written somewhere that somebody decided that the value of the real estate along that canal didn't warrant additional expenditure. Instead of going and inspecting every canal when that happened. And I would like to know if you all could find out the name of this individual, and if he's still alive, drown him.
Well, it's interesting. You know, the whole cost-benefit analysis aspect of the Corps of Engineers has proven to be just a complete and utter failure, hasn't it? I mean, 20 years ago, they could have spent $15 billion and built a world-class flood protection system for the city of New Orleans, and everybody decided it was too expensive. Now we've spent $110 billion, and it's just it's a matter of them going through their cost-benefit analysis and deciding, well, it costs too much for the projected benefit, but it turns out that all those numbers don't really matter much when the walls fall down. Now they've got a much more expensive problem to fix.
You know, if you still have Saturday's paper, the best source to read the mistakes made over the years is Bob Marshall has a story on our front page last weekend. Breaks into little pieces by 10-year increments, decisions that were made, opportunities to move the pump stations to the lake, opportunities to put gates out there. the chance to not build the eye wall. They built that eye wall because they didn't want to spend the money to buy expensive property in Lakeview, and it really gives you a great primer on exactly how we set the stage for Katrina.
We pay a lot of taxes to the levy board. What is their responsibility in all of this, other than having luncheon at a nice restaurant after they get driven around in their limousines to have their levy inspections?
Well, you read the paper, I can tell.
Well, we pay a huge amount of taxes for this, and it seems to me that they haven't even been mentioned as being responsible.
Well, there are other duties. I mean, they do harass teenagers on the lakefront, so it's not like they're just going to lunch.
They build casinos. They build marinas.
It's not a joke.
No,
well,
but,
I mean, the problem is this. I mean, ultimately, the levy board the levy board has been complicit in making decisions with the Corps that helped bring us to where we were. But at the end of the day, they didn't design the walls. They didn't make the engineering. They're not an engineering body. They're a patronage body. They always have been. They're a waste of time and money to some degree.
Well, we're going to have a chance.
We're going to have a chance to vote on that. You know, you're making a great point.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't be against it.
The levy board is not responsible for the design and construction, but they are supposed to maintain them and monitor them and keep you posted. We had people on Bel Air Drive complaining that water was bubbling up in their backyard and calling the sewage and water board, and it wasn't from their water pipes, and they tested the water and said it's coming from that canal. So there's no doubt that the levy board's job to inspect and alert and get things done, they didn't do it at all. And you have a chance to vote on their future at the end of September. There's one behind you.
Just yell it out. My
question would be, what about the rumors that have been running rampant about the destruction on purpose of the levees? I don't find the newspaper or anyone else doing enough to set this straight. Doing a big front page story, we tested this for whatever this or whatever that. You're going to have these rumors probably for hundreds of years now, unless they're put to an end immediately.
Well,
the question has to do with, in the back, for those of you who can't hear, the rumors about the levees being blown, particularly among African American residents in the city.
We did write a story about this. It was late last year. It has reemerged because Spike Lee's film, which is a very good film, has people on there who are out of state, and they heard those rumors. If you tried to refute every rumor running through New Orleans based on Katrina, it's a very difficult thing to do. I mean, you're talking about a storm that produced a record amount of information and even more misinformation. But all I tell people is there were more than 50 breaches in the levee system. That's a lot of bombing. I mean, you'd have to, like, send F-16s over the city and carpet bomb it. And my other answer is I tell people, you know, you don't need to blow up a levee built by the Army Corps.
They'll do it their
just add water and it'll fall apart.
Right.
But it goes back to the earlier question about the national media as well, and that one of the things they fail to convey as well is the indiscriminate nature of Katrina. A storm that did not care where you lived, what color your skin was, how much money you had, regardless, it struck everyone. And they've recently done a better job of that, but there still is a misperception about the extent of the storm on every level, social, cultural, socioeconomic.
Well, how many have heard the one about 400 bad guys were secretly killed by the police and thrown in the river? Has anyone heard that one? That one's... And my answer to that is, did none of these guys have mothers? There's no mothers? Nobody's looking for them? I mean, you know, there's just a lot of rumors.
If there was a story on it, I unfortunately didn't see it. But the Corps of Engineers has a very proud history of engineering excellence, up until recently. And when I say that, it seems like that institution, like a number of others over the course of the past 20 to 30 years, has been dumbed down. It used to be only, I believe, the top 10% of the Academy graduates from West Point were even eligible to become members of the Corps of Engineers. And yet, over that period of time, the last 20 to 25 years, so many of the Corps' blunders have become evident, and the most egregious is certainly Katrina in New Orleans. Any plans to do a Corps story?
Well, we got a whole team. We have had a whole team reporting on the Corps. I mean, you know, it's just like we covered the recovery, covering the Corps, and Bob Marshall and Mark Schlefting and Sheila Grissett, we have three reporters basically assigned full-time to disemboweling the Corps. Two things with the Corps of Engineers, though. One is, and they will be more apt to answer this than I would, but it's not just an issue of are the engineers bad, but is the organization is really the problem. You have divisions of the Corps of Engineers, this one building the canal, this one building the gates, who before Katrina did not talk to each other, didn't share plans. They admitted in their report, what we had was not a system. It was basically the addition of parts that didn't take into account how the water will move from this part to the other and so on. So I'm not sure if it's just that the engineers now are mediocre, but it's mostly the organization is.
It's a huge bureaucracy. The engineers have to meet the standards they set. And keep in mind, at the time Hurricane Katrina hit, they had not completed the levee hurricane protection plan that they launched after Betsy.
Right.
They weren't done building that yet. And now we find out that the one they were building was based on outdated science and storm models that weren't accurate anymore. So even if they had gotten it done, it wouldn't have protected us for the modern age of storms. So there's no doubt we need to have the whole Army Corps modernized. You know, don't forget, 80-something Corps employees lost their homes as well. And the people who are here working on this right now are not the same ones who designed what failed, first of all. And second of all, another misconception is the big, fat, old-fashioned earthen levee that we all think is outdated, they did great. It was the new technology, the new eye walls put in the early 1990s that fell apart.
Does Walmart have an engineering department?
there's one thing I'd like to mention, too, about the Corps. It's very easy to take the Corps and blame everything on the Corps, and they do share and they do have a huge responsibility, but we also share it, too. You know, when these plans to build the levees came along, and the reason they have walls instead of the big, fat earthen levees that work is because local politicians at the time didn't want to spend the local money, the local share, that needs to be spent to buy the property. So, I mean, how much taxes do we want to spend for our own protection and so on? And it's something we ought to think about for the future. You know, we do pay a certain amount of taxes, but, these cost much more than we think. And so we are going to have to shell out some, too, eventually, to build what we really need, which is a Category 5 protection system. And, our local politicians, and we're going to demand that our local politicians and that ourselves invest the political and monetary will to do so?
I'm really interested in the theme of leadership as it applies to Katrina. And I think you see on so many levels a massive failures of leadership, and that can be the epithet of the story. I mean, I was here staying in the Hotel Monteleone and watched the looters start on the Walgreens just in the middle of the afternoon as soon as the storm passed on Monday. Now, my contention is that had there been National Guard or some sort of leadership on the ground here, half of the nonsense that happened would not have happened. So you have these spectacular failures of leadership, yet at the same time, like yourselves, you've got great stories of people on the ground here showing wonderful leadership. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that topic, about leadership in the storm. I mean, where do you end up on that, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think we've written a lot about the public failure of leadership in the storm on many different levels. I think that just in a broader sense that Katrina is in some ways a case study in leadership, in the sense that we learn big crises require a different kind of leadership and a different brand of leadership than day-to-day life. And we certainly saw that in our newspaper. We see it around the city. We see it in the state. We see it at the federal level. That when something like this happens, it takes a different brand of leadership that seems, in this case, on a public level, to be in frighteningly short supply. But it is a case study in leadership. There are actually a lot of people writing books about what Katrina teaches us about leadership that I think we'll be talking about for quite a long time.